Hello and welcome back. This is Grace Junkies, a layman's view or layman's expose of apologetics. I don't know. I haven't figured out what I'm going to call it yet. But basically, I'm a layman. I have been studying apologetics for the last 2 years. I have no degrees or titles in it. And I'm doing this, as I've said in the introduction, in an attempt to familiarize myself with the arguments verbally. I'm going to try to do this without notes, but simply pull on what I have learned in a conversational way to prepare myself for the next stage, which is actually being in front of, hopefully in front of students and teenagers, preparing to off to go to college. There's more about that in the introduction if you care to listen. Please leave your feedback, positive or negative. Any encouragement is appreciated, but I especially look for where I didn't make sense, any type of criticism, where what I said didn't make sense, or I didn't back up what I said with some kind of resource, or I made some kind of assumption that was not, an obvious assumption, or like gravity exists, you know, that kind of thing. So I look forward to any of that. However, I'm not, as I've said in my introduction, I understand this is not going to be that interesting for most people. And there are much better resources out there for apologetics podcasts that you probably want to check out other than me. However, if you like me, please let me know. You can contact me at brad.mcfadden@gmail.com. Okay, on with the show. Today we're going to look at, or I'm going to talk about, the three stages of Western culture. And these are, and this is a broad overview. It's a very simplistic overview. I understand that. I'm painting with a giant roller. Okay. Now, there was basically three: pre-modern, modern, and post-modern. The way that we define truth in these different periods of time is what I'm mainly concerned with. Now, the pre-modern period is basically prior to the Renaissance, what we call the Renaissance in the 1500s. I believe it's when that started, 1600s. I don't know. I forget. But you know what I'm talking about, the Renaissance. And during this time, called pre-modernism, truth was viewed as revealed. Now, that we're talking, let me back up just a second. We're talking about Western culture now. There are basically two kind of schools of thought, or two schools of philosophy. That's Eastern thought and Western thought, okay? Philosophy means how we define truth. In its simplest form, if you look at it in the dictionary, it's going to say different things, but we're going to define philosophy for this discussion as how we define truth. And now there's Eastern thought and Western thought. Eastern thought, you have Buddhism, Hinduism, and the Bible fits into Eastern thought, believe it or not. And this is good versus evil. This is what comes out of this kind of thinking. Wisdom is valued over knowledge in this kind of thinking. A good example of this is Psalm 73. If you want to read, that's very Eastern-like thinking. Karma, what comes around goes around. You live by the sword, die by the sword. These kinds of things come out of Eastern thought. Western thought is basically originated in Greece, or kind of comes from the rise of the Grecian civilization, and then is carried on through Roman civilization. We're talking about Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. Things that come out of this are like idealism and knowledge as being superior to wisdom. In other words, the more you know, then the better, then the more you can apply. And they're not saying wisdom is not important. They're just saying that it really focused on knowledge. And existentialism comes out of this, existentialism. And really in Western thought, what we're concerned with back in the beginning of this philosophy is existence, is being, is why do we exist? How do we exist? What is the nature of our being? That's what kind of they were looking at. And by extension, they were expressly concerned with knowledge, because they thought the more they could learn about particular things, or then the more they would understand this idea of being. Okay, sorry for that little backtrack. Now we move jump back where I was, which is in pre-modernism. In pre-modernism, the truth was revealed, okay? And that's the way truth was viewed. It was absolute, but it was revealed. And it's the way teachers acted in their classrooms. We're talking about even people who do not believe in the Bible, necessarily like in Greek. Truth was still revealed. It was you could seek it. There were things you could do to pursue it, but ultimately it had to be revealed by the teacher, by the sophisticate, as they called them. And truth was absolute. Later in the modern period, it was really truth was God centered. It was providence that revealed. It was providence that revealed truth. Truth was transcendent. It didn't matter. This goes back to truth is absolute. Truth is transcendent. It didn't matter what age you were, where you lived, what culture you existed in. Truth was truth. Truth was actual. It wasn't some kind of idea. It was very concrete in that way. And truth defined logic, which is important because this is a view that you had a truth, and your logic had to fit around that truth. Now, that doesn't seem like that big of a deal, but when you compare that to the way truth is viewed today, it very much is the opposite of what happens. And we'll get to that in a minute. During this time, this is when the Textus Receptus was, if you want to boil this down into what it means to Christianity and apologetics. This was when the Textus Receptus was assembled. When the Bible as we know it, today being the King James Version of the Bible, when it was assembled, when that canon was assembled as the Textus Receptus, which was way before the King James, has nothing to do with the King James really, except that the King James was based on the Textus Receptus. But when that was assembled, that was done in a pre-modern sort of philosophy where truth is revealed and truth was absolute. And so, you know, you've got to kind of understand the Bible scholars of that time were Wycliffe and Luther, these kind of people. The church that existed during this time was Catholicism, and the Reformation happened in this time. Right after the Reformation is when we get into modernism. Now, in modernism, things change, and this is basically because of the scientific, the the guy who looked at the stars, I can't even say his name. How frustrating for me. Galileo. Yeah. I have to look that up. Wow. Okay. Him. He's sort of the founding, it's not because of what he did, but he's the turning point into modernism, where truth is discovered, and it goes into the scientific method was developed at the early part of modernism period, and through man's own efforts, it didn't require God to reveal truth. Through man's own efforts, he could find God. Now, in the beginning, this wasn't necessarily completely sacrilegious or completely anti-religious, because it was because the earth was structured. Because God had ordered the earth, that man believed he could figure out this order, that man believed he could discover this order, that it had been laid out by God, and that any investigation into into science and studying of the order of the universe and the order of what had been created was a study into God and into God's glory and depths of his creation. So that's how it was, you know, viewed in the beginning. But at the later period of modernism, you just simply have the death of God. We don't need God anymore because we can discover all the truth we need for ourselves, and we can improve life all by ourselves. And, you know, it was this transformation that happened during modernism. Truth, like I said, it was discovered, but it was still absolute. It was not transcendent. It was only external. It was only what could be measured and what could be scientifically tested, you know, through the method and experimented. So truth was also developing, with every truth that you discovered, there were many more things that you obviously didn't know, and every answer revealed more questions. And so truth was viewed as developing over time, and that man was becoming closer and closer to ultimate truth. truth was still constrained by logic. It didn't define logic, but it was constrained by logic. And this is the beginning of the shift there. It was a gradual way of shifting the thought a little bit. Truth, a truth that was discovered had to fit into a certain logical sort of construct. And that did not mean the same thing as truth was defined by logic, because, in other words, in truth is defined by logic, you could start with pure logic, okay, and then come out with truth. So, you know, 1 plus 1 is 2. That's logic, and so therefore 2 is the truth of 1 plus 1. When you have this new kind of way of thinking that truth is constrained by logic, then you're more of we know that 1 plus 1 has to be more than 1 and less than 3. You understand? Because there's not no absolute 1, and there's not an absolute 1 to add it to, so it gets kind of gray, and it's constrained by this logical thinking, and it's just a small shift, but it allows for some crisis that follow. During this time, because truth is discovered, you have Westcott and Hort coming up with their, and this is, like I said, a very oversimplification of what's going on here, but you do have the Westcott and Hort document coming out of this period of time as they go back and they try to discover a more accurate scripture as opposed to the Textus Receptus. Since the Textus Receptus was created or was put together, Westcott and Hort argued that many more scientific and archaeological discoveries have been made. We need to examine those archaeological discoveries to see if they're older than the Textus Receptus. Their assumption here is that older is more accurate, which is not necessarily true. One of the main flaws of their thinking is that an older document would be more accurate. The reason why that's a flaw is because it may be very possible that the more accurate documents, the more accurate texts, wore out quicker because they were used more often. And in fact, the two that they used were both from Alexandria, and where one was found in a garbage in an ancient garbage pile, basically. So it was thrown out. And you got to wonder, you know, was it thrown out because it was inaccurate or because it was considered heresy? We don't know. It could very well be completely accurate, but it's just an assumption that they made. And it was sort of, and it fit in with the thinking of the time that through my own efforts, I can discover more of what God meant, or a better translation of what God originally intended. And then that's not necessarily the way that a pre-modernist would have approached the issue. So there you have it. So Westcott and Hort, by the way, their text is what most of today's Bibles, besides the King James Version, are based upon or come from. They use their findings and their Alexandrian texts. The Minority Text is also called. Okay, moving on. The turning point thinker in this is Descartes, who was the big, you know, doubter. And a real big result of this in modernism, of this kind of thinking, is Darwin. Modernism is Darwin and Darwinism. And by the time you get to Darwinism, you start having philosophers like Nietzsche come out and say, hey, we don't need God anymore, or God is antiquated. He doesn't really serve a purpose in current thinking and in modern scientific thinking and modern science and modern philosophy. Nietzsche gets a bad rap, but he really pointed out very clearly why, if you ever read Nietzsche, why this is so terrible. I mean, he wasn't like he said, God is dead, hooray. It was, God is dead, we're doomed. And it wasn't like he was a Christian either. He really did believe that there was no God, but it drove him crazy. It drove him to insanity, because there's also the crisis that developed out of modernism. And the reason we have postmodernism is because there was no, in with all this rational, all this scientific method, all of this, if it cannot be measured and tested, it doesn't exist, and therefore God's sort of part, not part of science and not part of rational thinking. Well, then you're left with this great crisis in philosophy that there's no basis for moral, for moral rules and moral aptitude. There's no real reason for ethics. There's no substantial or logical way to establish true ethics and moral behavior. That's why Nietzsche said that he talked about a Superman and about how you just impose your will on another. And but even he said even that is pure meaningless. And so even his answer was, that's why he went crazy. He spent his last years in a mental institution. And you have a lot of this, going on in this period of time, that a lot of the philosophers sort of saying the same sort of things. And it's very, very depressing. The philosophy of this period of time is very depressing, and we can't know anything, these kinds of things. We're worthless, we're meaningless. This is sort of the result of a lot of this thinking. So we come to what we have today. The answer to that crisis and was postmodernism. Now, the reason why, or sort of how it developed, was people said, well, there's got to be a reason for ethics and moral, or society will break apart and fall apart. And in fact, Nietzsche predicted that it would. This sort of thinking developed out of this, that you can tell a lie and believe a lie even though you know it's a lie. It's kind of like Santa Claus. This is the way they viewed ethics going forward. That we all know there's no real reason for ethics, but we still need ethics to survive as a society. So we'll continue to believe that there's a need and that there's a real moral truth and a moral wrong, a true wrong and a true right. And that even though we know that let's say the rape of a 3-year-old for our own pleasure is not really, there's nothing really wrong about that because there's no moral objective truth to judge it by. There's no God. There's no judgment of that. However, we need, we all recognize as a society that is wrong. We all feel that it's wrong. We are disgusted by it. We wish to punish people who do it and break that moral code. So because this moral code sort of exists in us through natural selection or through our society's evolution or just through the believing in myths, it doesn't matter how it arose. What matters is it's there and it's helpful, so we will continue to believe it. Which, because that was sort of the answer, and it was a really bad answer, you get this new age kind of thinking. And that's where we're all, everybody believes these things are morally wrong. So we're all part of this collective energy that believe the same thing. And there are many paths to God or the universe, as sometimes it's called. It's not even called God anymore. The universe or the force. That was the Star Wars thing. But that there is the New Ages call it the universe or what's another word for it? They call it the conscious stream of the universe or whatever. So they said it doesn't matter if you're Buddhist, it doesn't matter if you're Christian, it doesn't matter if you're Hindu. What really matters is that you believe in something that gives you a good moral foundation so that you can be a good human. And this is humanism comes out of this, which is really, it's really crazy because it leads to things like anti-humanism, but nevertheless, I won't go down that road. Truth then here in postmodernism becomes perceived. Again, to review, pre-modernism, truth is revealed. In modernism, truth is discovered, and now truth is perceived. Okay, this is the way, you may have heard in a postmodern statement of, well, what's true for you may not be true for me, or that's your truth, or, well, you know, there's many ways to, well, I already said that, there's many ways to God. These are postmodern ideas, and this is truth being perceived. I perceive my truth to be this. And a lot of this is experiential. In other words, my experience leads me to these conclusions, and your experience may lead you to different conclusions. Both are true and valid. The problem with that is that Christianity is exclusive. It says that there is only one way to God. No one comes to the Father but through Jesus. And so these sort of ideas contradict postmodernism. And I would love to tell you today that postmodern ideas, Christianity is more relevant than it's been in the last 100 years. And there are some people who say that, but it's simply not true. Mainly because of its exclusivity, because we as Christians believe ours is the only way, then, and without a saving, supernatural, saving relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ, that there is no other way to God, no other way to reconcile with God. Because of that belief, then we really don't fit in with postmodernism. And when push comes to shove, they will kick you out of their club. They're okay with you as long as you don't play that card. And that's just the way it is. This postmodernism is idea-centered. Truth is situational. This is the rise in divorce, and all that comes from this idea that truth can change. What's true for me today is that I love you. What's true for me tomorrow is, well, that love is worn out, and now it's time to find new love. And you know what? The situation that when I fell in love with you, our situations were different. And now we have both changed to become different people, and our situation is completely different, and we just don't make any sense anymore. And this kind of truth, this is the rise in divorce. Let's see, what else? Truth is relative, yes. Now, knowledge and truth, well, I don't want to go into that. We talked about truth being defined by logic in pre-modernism, then truth being constrained by logic in modernism. In post-modernism, logic and truth are completely separate. Logic is logic and has nothing to do with truth. Truth is a personal thing because there is no absolute truth. And logic is this other realm of things which you can't, you know, you can discuss, but you can't really argue about because it's either logical or it's not. And so you have the statement about, well, that's not logical. In other words, which replaces the old statement of, well, that's not true. You know, nobody says that's not true. I mean, if somebody says that today, it's more about an experience. I didn't say that. That's not true. Not something is, if you're having a philosophical conversation, you wouldn't say that's not true. You would say that's not logical. And many of the debates, you know, are all about logical fallacies and logic and not about accepted truths. So there you have the three stages of thinking: pre-modernism, modernism, and postmodernism, and how truth is viewed through each stage. I hope it made some sense. It makes sense in my head, but I'll listen back through this and see if it actually makes sense of what I said. The references for this talk are sort of obscure. I don't really have any links that set this up as I presented it. It has been broken down to me in several lectures, but I don't really have links to those lectures. They were just part of in the iTunes. For instance, there was one in the iTunes University from a Lutheran lecture, and I'll try to find a link to that. But it's through iTunes, so you have to have iTunes to get it. And then there's some of this in a book this is when it talks about the difference in the Westcott and Hort and the difference with the Bible. Oh, I didn't tell you about the Bible in the postmodern era. We have all these different versions of the Bible because there's that's another that I forgot to finish that train of thought there. So we have the Bible pre-modern being, you know, basically just the Textus Receptus. In postmodernism, you have the Westcott and Hort coming out, and in postmodernism, you have all these different versions of the Bible because truth is perceived. So the more different perceptions that you can create of the same text, then the more people you're going to reach, and you want to reach people at their level. You want to reach people where they are, and this idea of behind. And I'm not saying it's necessarily bad. I'm not coming against the Message or any of the different Bible versions. I'm just saying this is what comes out of this kind of thinking, and it's important, I think, to understand where our culture is meeting us as far as the Bible is concerned. So, there's a great book called The Revision Revised. It's by Dean John William Burgeon. It's basically Slamon, Westcott, and Hort, he is a renowned scholar, and it is a great book and a great wealth of information about, just about the Bible and its origins and how, the difference in how Westcott and Hort looked at it versus how it was originally put together. So, very, very good to know if especially if you read different versions of the Bible today. It's a real good resource to figure out or to see what kind of thinking went into the different versions that you're reading. Okay, so as far as other resources for this talk, they're kind of wide. I mean, you can find this kind of if you look at any philosophy or introduction to Western thought. Book, you will see these breakdowns of premodernism, modernism, and postmodernism. And the reason why I got into this is because when I got into apologetics, I found a lot of talk about postmodernism, but it was loosely defined, but there was no real background. I mean, I don't understand. Everybody's talking about postmodernism, but I don't understand. So I did a specific research into this area of philosophy and discovered that there were these three stages and what they all meant. And this was a fast sort of, this might be better in a conversation than it was just as a talk, but this is what I put together over several months, or probably 2 months of study into just this area of what, how postmodernism came to be and the crises that happened in philosophy that resulted in postmodernism. And that's a lot more detail that I didn't really want to get into here, but it was a fascinating study, at least for me. I don't know if it was for you. So there you have it. There it is. I gave you my contact information at the beginning, so I guess I'm done. Vayos con Dios.